Hello again, and welcome to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the September 6th to September 12th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an illustration depicting a football team in red uniforms in formation at the line of scrimmage. On the other side of the line of scrimmage, we see only a rather confused-looking donkey, who seems to have just taken a bite out of the field. The headline, America's Missing Opposition. The cover leader will be America's Missing Opposition. Donald Trump is unpopular. Why is it so hard to stand up to him? Republicans are servile. Courts are slow. Can the Democrats rouse themselves? After the cover leader, we'll hear four additional leader section articles, beginning with Fiscal Fistfight, How Europe's Hard Right Threatens the Economy. At best, the continent should expect stagnation. At worst, a bond market rout. Then, the summit at Tianjin and Beijing, Xi Jinping's anti-American party. To see the cost of Trump's bullying, tally the world leaders flocking to China. Then, Prabowo's choice. Indonesia could be on the brink of something nasty. The president should heed protesters rather than crushing them. Then, for the final leader, we will have Education and Technology. Schools should banish smartphones from the classroom. Grades will rise, and pupils will be happier. After that, we'll go to the Americas section for Put That in Your Pipe and Store It. Mexico fears the United States will stop the flow of natural gas. Sheinbaum must confront her country's energy mess. Then to the United States section for Struggle Sessions. Donald Trump comes for America's public universities, but so far only those in enemy territory. And then, in observance of the beginning of football season, we'll go to the culture section for Lonely at the Top. Quarterbacks shoulder an immense burden on the field, and life off the field is often harder. So that is the lineup. Let's go back to the top for the cover leader. America's Missing Opposition. Donald Trump is unpopular. Why is it so hard to stand up to him? Republicans are servile. Courts are slow. Can the Democrats rouse themselves? If a single political idea has tied Americans together over their first quarter of a millennium, it is that one-person rule is a mistake. Most Americans also agree that the federal government is slow and incompetent. Together, these things ought to make it impossible for one man to govern by diktat from the White House. Yet that is what this president is doing, sending in the troops, slapping on tariffs, asserting control over the central bank, taking stakes in companies, scaring citizens into submission. The effect is overwhelming, but not popular. President Donald Trump's net approval rating is minus 14 percentage points. That is little better than Joe Biden's after his dire debate last year, and no one fretted that he was overmighty. This is a puzzle. Most Americans disapprove of Mr. Trump, yet everywhere he seems to be getting his way. Why? One answer is that he moves much faster than the lumbering forces that constrain him. He is like the TikTok algorithm, grabbing attention and moving on to the next thing before his opponents have worked out what just happened. The Supreme Court has yet even to consider whether deploying troops to Los Angeles in June was lawful. While the justices take their time, the president may soon use the same routine in Chicago. The court may not rule on the legality of his tariffs for months. So far, the president has obeyed Supreme Court rulings, but if one legal avenue is closed, he will try another, and the clock resets. Another answer is that the Republican Party always lets him have his way. It is not just that he dominates it with an approval rating among Republicans of almost 90%. It is that the party's organizing idea is that Mr. Trump is always right, even when he contradicts himself. policy debates have turned into theological disputation in which sides fight over the real meaning of his words. Independent institutions, companies, universities, or news organizations might oppose him, but they suffer from a coordination problem. This is much easier to point out than to fix, because organizations that compete with each other would have to collaborate. What is bad for Harvard may not be bad for its rivals. If a single law firm can be picked off, its business may go to a competitor. Behind all these lurks the ugly reality of Mr. Trump's vindictiveness and intimidation. Previous presidents were influenced by independent-minded experts and the cabinet. The new definition of an expert in the Oval Office is someone who agrees with the boss. Bearers of bad news are sacked. Awkward Republicans primaried, business leaders punished, opponents investigated. For each, the rational response is to apologize, settle, and hope that someone else will do the right thing. Having seen what that entails, someone else may prefer a quiet life. Politically, therefore, the main task of opposition falls to the Democrats. They are, to put it kindly, confused. Should they fight Mr. Trump with all caps posts, as Gavin Newsom is doing? Is it all about mastering curated authenticity, like Zoran Mamdani? Do they move left? Do they occupy the center? Is the problem merely one of messaging that can be fixed if only activists would stop calling women birthing people? The fact that Democrats can neither constrain Mr. Trump nor even communicate clearly leaves their base angry. Mr. Trump's ratings are low, but he is more popular than the Democratic Party. Not because Republicans and independents disapprove of it, though they do, but because Democrats disapprove of themselves. In the short run, the self-loathing may be overdone. The midterms are a year away. In 10 of the 12 elections for the House of Representatives this century, voters have turned against the party that holds the presidency. Gerrymandering, which will reduce the number of competitive seats in the House from few to almost none, means that even a president this unpopular is unlikely to suffer a landslide defeat in 2026. But a Democratic House with subpoena power would provide a crucial check on presidential corruption and incompetence. In the long run, though, that looks like false comfort. The Democratic brand is damaged. Democrats are more trusted by the electorate on health care, the environment, and democracy. But on many issues voters care about, including crime and immigration, they prefer Republicans. In the 2024 election, Kamala Harris was seen as more extreme than Mr. Trump. Saying the voters are wrong or sexist to think this way is not helpful. Demography is no longer the Democrats' friend. Under Mr. Trump, Republicans have made progress with non-white and young voters. The Democrats have lost the white working class. Although the most educated voters like them, only 40% of Americans aged 25 or over have a college degree. These changes mean the story Democrats have long told themselves, that they represented the real majority in America, but Republican machinations kept them out of power, is no longer true, if it ever was. Now they benefit from a lower turnout. 10 years into the Trump era, Democrats are still underestimating him. His skill in setting traps for them is extraordinary. Take the looming vote in Congress on raising the federal debt ceiling. Democrats will have to choose between more cuts to foreign aid and shutting the government. Or take sending troops into cities, supposedly to fight crime. Democrats decry executive overreach. Mr. Trump places them on the side of criminals and danger. Or take drone strikes on alleged drug smugglers. It is hard to oppose the lack of any due process without sounding like a defender of violent gangs. Democrats have choices about whether to walk into those traps. Lots of them think, rightly, that Mr. Trump poses a danger to the country's democratic values and conclude that this alone should make him toxic to most voters. Alas, it does not. Instead, The question Democrats need to keep asking themselves is this: why do voters think they are the extremists rather than the guy trying to establish one-man rule? That was The Cover Leader, America's Missing Opposition. Donald Trump is unpopular. Why is it so hard to stand up to him? Republicans are servile. Courts are slow. Can the Democrats rouse themselves? And we continue on now with leader article number 2. Fiscal fistfight. How Europe's hard right threatens the economy. At best, the continent should expect stagnation. At worst, a bond market rout. Insurgents who want to smash the system often end up running it. For Europe's hard right, that outcome is already a glimmer on the horizon. They are ahead in the polls, or thereabouts, in Britain, France, and Germany. In Italy, they are in power. In the Netherlands, they briefly led a coalition. And in Poland, in June, their presidential candidates saw off the nominee from the center. By 2027, the hard right could be in office in economies worth getting on for half of European GDP. That would be a grave blow to European prosperity. The direct threat is the hard right's use of power. They sneer at technocratic management, vow to protect voters from competition and creative destruction, and instead offer a seductive combination of handouts and tax cuts. Outright electoral success would mean more economic stagnation or even rolling bond market blow-ups. The indirect threat is that in some places, mainstream parties are already cowering before the populist uprising, ducking difficult reforms and aping policies from the extreme, a style of government that risks hastening the very hard-right victory they are seeking to avoid. Europe's economy has hardly been well run in recent years. Annual GDP is rising at just 1%. Britain's 30-year gilt yield reached 5.7% on September 2nd, its highest in over a quarter of a century. After François Bayrou, France's prime minister, announced a confidence vote in his government to be held on September 8th, the country's 30-year bond yield reached 4.46%, its highest since 2008. Germany, once the continent's economic motor, has barely grown since 2019. You might think that such a dismal record only bolsters the case from the hard right that Europe needs a new approach. It does, but not the change they propose. In fact, Europe can ill afford a period of even worse economic management. It is worth pinning down where the dangers lie. As we report, hard right parties have tended to moderate as they have moved closer to power. Proposals to ditch the euro or leave the European Union are now mostly symbolic, although Alternative for Germany still flirts with Dexit. Recognizing how Europe is aging, they now argue for guest worker schemes to supply new labor rather than shutting borders altogether. Above all, they want to avoid the sort of economic disruption that scares voters. However, this resistance to change makes them growth smotherers. In Italy, Giorgia Meloni has been relatively moderate, including towards Europe, but she has avoided growth-boosting reforms that would upset her voters. In America, MAGA has a pro-tech, deregulatory wing that competes for the president's attention against the nostalgia of many Trump supporters. In Europe, by contrast, populism is all about preserving an imaginary past. Hard right success would lock in Europe's least productive features: transfers to favored groups, protectionism, and hostility to competition. An even greater problem is the hard right's fiscal profligacy. Populist parties almost all advocate a mixture of tax cuts combined with generosity for pensioners and parents of young children, in order to boost the native birth rate. They claim that they will balance the books with huge savings from cutting spending on immigrants, scroungers, public sector waste, and Brussels. Reform UK promises giveaways worth around £200 billion, or $266 billion, or 5% of British GDP, according to our calculations, funded by an incredible £100 billion worth of savings, including an unspecified 5% cut across the whole of government. The party reckons it can find £42 billion by cutting immigration and £10 billion from better managing public sector pensions. Bond markets will surely puncture such illusions. Indeed, the combination of low growth and budgetary ill-discipline leads inexorably towards fiscal crisis. In the best case, this would enforce a dose of sanity. In Italy, where memories of the euro crisis are still fresh, and the government depends on EU-level budget approval for access to support from the European Central Bank, or ECB, Ms. Meloni is running a tight fiscal ship. But in the event of a euro crisis, populism will redouble the peril. Today, the ECB is in all but name the lender of last resort to governments. Markets have implicit faith in the vow of Mario Draghi, the former ECB president, to do, quote, whatever it takes to keep the euro area together, so long as governments show what a former official has termed, quote, macroeconomic reasonability. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, the bloc had enough unity to put together fiscal insurance in the form of a recovery fund. Would that still be true if President Marine Le Pen or Jordan Bardella were running a National Rally, or RN, government in France? In a Eurozone crisis, national governments would have to work with each other and the ECB at all-night summits. The markets would harshly punish any dithering or division. For decades, the answer to every crisis has been, quote, more Europe. Recent crises have led to common bank supervision and the issuance of joint bonds. Such solutions would be hard to stomach for parties that promise their voters, quote, less Europe. You do not have to be George Soros to predict that bond investors will test the Eurozone's cohesion if the RN is elected. All this may seem speculative, but its shadow hangs over the economy even today, because many mainstream politicians are unwilling or unable to pursue reforms for fear that they will provide ammunition to their rivals. Last year, Mr. Draghi unveiled a host of recommendations designed to boost Europe's economy, including integrating the continent's financial markets and many ways to cut red tape. Those proposals have gone precisely nowhere. Europe's politicians are in a bind. Change would make them unpopular. Austerity would burnish the hard right's extravagant promises. But caution, however tempting, perpetuates the rot that corrodes voters' trust in politics. The Economist does not underestimate the courage it will take to pursue bold change. But the miserable defeatist alternative is to surrender the initiative to the hard right. That was our second leader, Fiscal Fistfight: How Europe's Hard Right Threatens the Economy. At best, the continent should expect stagnation. At worst, a bond market rout. And we'll proceed now to leader article number 3, the summit at Tianjin and Beijing. Xi Jinping's anti-American party. To see the cost of Trump's bullying, tally the world leaders flocking to China. You may think the place where national leaders gather to talk about the state of the world is Washington, or perhaps the UN headquarters in New York. In fact, as President Xi Jinping showed when he hosted over 20 presidents and prime ministers in China this week, a new reality is taking hold. Mr. Xi used a summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO, in Tianjin to advertise China as a source of stability and prosperity. He used a military parade in Beijing, marking the 80th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, to remind everyone that China has become a mighty power. The source of trouble today, he suggests, is America. Mr. Xi's claim to lead a global coalition of America skeptic powers is not as fantastical as you might think. He received autocrats like Vladimir Putin of Russia and Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who travel by armored train. But he also welcomed leaders of countries that have leant towards the West, including Turkey, Egypt, and India, which is furious after Donald Trump singled it out for punitive tariffs and embraced its enemy, Pakistan, after a conflict in May. China's boast to be an anchor of stability has weight, at least in some respects. The country is already the largest goods trading partner of most of this week's visitors, along with another 40-odd states around the world. As the Trump administration pursues a rolling campaign of economic warfare against its trading partners, China's sins of mercantilism and state capitalism look minor by comparison. There is also a newfound unity opposing sanctions, including the extraterritorial threat America uses to sever individuals, firms, and countries from the dollar-based financial system and tech platforms. More and more countries are interested in finding alternatives to the dollar, and fewer will be interested in enforcing America's sanctions on its behalf. China's guests still have plenty to disagree about. India opposes its military buildup after skirmishes on the Himalayan border. China's neighbors must have watched its new missiles trundle through Tiananmen Square with mixed feelings. Yet, among the autocrats, cooperation is deepening. Russia and North Korea are working on space and satellite systems. In return for China's support over Ukraine, Russia is thought to be offering it more of its most sensitive military technology, including submarine propulsion and missile defense systems. The weakest part of Mr. Xi's campaign is over international institutions and rules. He has just declared that, quote, global governance has reached a new crossroads. State media proposed that China should work with like-minded countries to uphold the UN Charter and, quote, build a more just and equitable global governance system. Despite being cloaked in the language of multilateralism, these are code words for a China-friendly world order in which big powers dominate spheres of influence and enjoy more rights than small ones. Few countries want Asia to be run by China. Not everyone at Mr. Xi's Big Bash agrees with each other on everything. The SCO is a far cry from a NATO-style alliance. Other than the unifying factor of disenchantment with Mr. Trump's America, these countries often have little in common. European leaders were noticeably absent from the celebrations. Yet, convening disparate parties with different interests is not a sign of weakness. It is what superpowers are uniquely able to do. To have China shepherd so many leaders through Tianjin and Beijing was a display of its growing power. China does not yet command a new world order, but it does show how much damage Mr. Trump is doing to American interests. That was leader number three, the summit in Tianjin and Beijing, Xi Jinping's anti-American party. To see the cost of Trump's bullying, tally the world leaders flocking to China. And we'll move on now to our fourth leader, Prabowo's choice. Indonesia could be on the brink of something nasty. The president should heed protesters rather than crushing them. The spark was a young man's death. A motorbike delivery driver was passing a protest outside Indonesia's parliament on August 28th, just as a police vehicle surged forward. It crushed him. The video went viral, and mostly peaceful demonstrations turned into nationwide riots. Looters sacked the homes of five officials, including the finance minister. The original protest was about a lavish housing allowance that Indonesian lawmakers have awarded themselves, worth nearly 10 times the minimum wage in Jakarta, the capital. Now, Indonesians are furious about many things, from heavy-handed policing to the grubby misrule of Prabowo Subianto, the former general who was elected president last year. The country could be on the brink of serious unrest, and Mr. Prabowo's governing style is largely to blame. He dislikes having to deal with opposition, and so has pursued a strategy of co-opting all the other political parties by welcoming them into a ridiculously broad coalition. Fully 7 of the 8 parties in the lower house have joined it. Mr. Prabowo is trying to persuade the last one to come on board too. His bloated cabinet has over 100 members, up from around 50 under the previous administration. Mr. Prabowo claims that this setup suits the country's culture. Javanese people are polite, he insists, and dislike open disputation. He has suggested that his mega coalition should become permanent. That is a dismal idea. It would be an open door to corruption. To keep the factions happy, Mr. Prabowo has already doled out bungs, such as that housing allowance. With no opposition in Parliament, disgruntled Indonesians would have no way to complain, save taking to the streets, and it would reduce pressure on Mr. Prabowo to govern better. Such pressure is urgently needed. Mr. Prabowo is mismanaging the economy. Annual growth was a tolerable 5.1% in the second quarter of this year, but problems are bubbling under the bonnet. Indonesia has prematurely deindustrialized. The share of GDP from manufacturing has fallen by half in 2 decades. The country has failed to use its resources well. Despite huge oil and gas reserves, it has spent 20 years as a net oil importer. Its solar and wind potential has barely been exploited. Life, for many, is hard. The cost of staples has jumped. A kilo of rice is 34% pricier than 3 years ago. Layoffs are increasingly common. University graduates are more and more likely to be unemployed. Families struggle with debt. The share of bank loans to households that are non-performing has surged to its highest on record. Grappling with these ills requires wise structural reforms. Instead, Mr. Prabowo has ordered a 9% cut to the government's budget to pay for a free school lunch program and a new sovereign wealth fund. The fund has taken over state-owned enterprises and now receives their dividends, leading to a sharp drop in government revenues, which are already squeezed by low prices for commodities such as nickel. The free lunch scheme is supposed to reduce stunting, but the way to do that is to help children in the womb and before the age of 2, not at school. The Sovereign Wealth Fund is accountable only to Mr. Prabowo. A mightier tool to promote cronyism is hard to imagine. Sensibly, the president has agreed to cancel MPs' new housing allowances. But the big risk is that he will use violent protests as an excuse to crack down even more heavily. Indonesia is nothing like the police state it was under Suharto, a dictator who was ousted by protests in 1998. But Mr. Prabowo, who married Suharto's daughter, is clearly nostalgic for the old authoritarian habits. That is no way to hold together a multi-ethnic archipelago of 17,000 islands, let alone to govern it well. That was Leader Article number 4, Prabowo's Choice. Indonesia could be on the brink of something nasty. The president should heed protesters rather than crushing them. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, this program featuring articles from the September 6th to September 12th edition of the magazine. And we'll proceed now to our fifth and final leader article for this program, Education and Technology. Schools should banish smartphones from the classroom. Grades will rise and pupils will be happier. Back in the 20th century, bored scholars had to make do with flicking rubber bands at their classmates, doodling in their textbooks, or staring out of the window. Modern technology has revolutionized slacking. Most teenagers in the rich world own smartphones. Many are allowed to bring them into classrooms, where each provides a bottomless source of apps designed to be as compelling and distracting as possible. A backlash is underway as parents and teachers worry about the effects on classroom performance. On August 27th, South Korea passed a ban on smartphones in classrooms. Governments from China to Finland, as well as dozens of American states, have introduced bans and restrictions of varying severity. The Economist is queasy about micromanaging the job of head teachers to such a degree. But schools that still welcome smartphones would be wise to think again. This may seem fusty and technophobic. It is not. Even diehard libertarians agree that children do not always know what is in their own interests. Nor does banishing phones from math lessons mean depriving children of experience with modern technology. They get plenty of that outside school. Gaps can be patched up in dedicated lessons. Technophiles like to point to a long history of misplaced skepticism about technology and its impact on education. A favorite example is Plato, who complained about the baleful effects of writing on the grounds that storing facts and arguments on scrolls would erode people's ability to remember them. But just because Plato was wrong 2,000 years ago does not mean that today's worries are misguided. Plato never put his claims to the test, whereas a growing body of research suggests that phones are indeed bad for schoolchildren. A recent study, run by an international team of academics and conducted in India, was a randomized controlled trial, the gold standard. As we report this week, it followed 17,000 higher education students for 3 years. It concluded that requiring phones to be left outside classrooms led to a small but measurable improvement in grades. The weakest students benefited most of all. Admittedly, the evidence is not yet overwhelming. The Indian study found only small gains. Its results contain quirks. They suggest, for instance, that bans lift performance in the first and third years of a degree, but not in the second, which is odd. Although its conclusions match those of studies in England and Spain, one in Sweden found that bans had no effect. Yet most educational interventions have only a small effect on grades. Scientists and researchers can afford to wait for the evidence to improve before issuing a final verdict. But teachers cannot. They must do the best they can for children in their classrooms with whatever evidence is available today. And the benefits of restricting smartphone use may go beyond better exam results. One of the more striking findings in the Indian study was that, after a while, the bans became popular with students. That fits with anecdotes from young people, which suggest the problem is in part one of collective action. If most pupils are socializing on phones, then anyone who tries to focus on lessons instead is missing out. If schools impose a blanket ban, there is nothing to miss out on. Smartphones are far from the only problem schools face, but they are one that is easy to solve. At a time when educational progress seems to be in reverse around the world, any school that has not restricted them should consider doing so. In the long run, their pupils might even thank them for it. That was the fifth and final Leader article in this issue, Education and Technology. Schools should banish smartphones from the classroom. Grades will rise, and the pupils will be happier. And we move over now to the Americas section for Put That in Your Pipe and Store It, Mexico fears the United States will stop the flow of natural gas. Sheinbaum must confront her country's energy mess. Last year, Mexico imported 2.34 trillion cubic feet of natural gas from the United States, up by nearly 40% from 2018. The increase is not just down to growing energy demand. Gas has become the backbone of Mexico's energy system. It accounts for more than 60% of electricity generation, largely in combined cycle plants. Natural gas is viewed as a bridge fuel as countries move away from coal and oil and towards clean energy. Mexico has been making use of its enviable access to the world's cheapest supply of natural gas, produced just across the border in Texas. But that arrangement is politically fraught for President Claudia Sheinbaum. Until the turn of the 21st century, Mexico produced all the natural gas it needed. Then demand outpaced production by Pemex, Mexico's national oil company. With the monopoly it then had, it produced gas only as a byproduct of its more lucrative oil operations. When gas output peaked in 2009 and power cuts followed, the shale boom in Texas presented a solution. Mexico built new pipelines, and CFE, the state electricity firm, began producing ever more electricity at combined cycle plants. Sweeping energy reforms in 2013 should have reduced Mexico's dependence on the imports. They opened the oil and gas sector to private investment, allowing for expanded pipelines and storage facilities. But when Andrés Manuel López Obrador, Ms. Sheinbaum's predecessor, took power in 2018, he kneecapped those plans. Mr. López Obrador railed against dependency, but his passion for oil led him to double down on Pemex despite its declining fields and ballooning debts. He discouraged renewables and dismissed fracking. He suspended pipeline contract payments, sidelined the private sector, and dismantled the industry's independent regulators. Without the money and expertise of outsiders, domestic production of oil and gas stagnated. As dependency has deepened, it has come to the political fore. Donald Trump's return to the White House stoked fears that he could turn off the taps. In a more general sense, Morena, Ms. Sheinbaum's party, frets about the loss of sovereignty implied by a reliance on foreign energy. Should Mexico worry? Mr. Trump has shown a readiness to weaponize whatever tools are available to him. Yet Oscar Ocampo of IMCO, a think tank in Mexico City, says the idea that he would cut off Mexico's gas is, quote, absurd. He has consistently pushed countries to buy more of America's hydrocarbons, not less. And Luisa Palacios, an energy expert at Columbia University, says Mexico absorbs about 70% of America's pipeline gas exports. The dependence is mutual. Worries over energy sovereignty are shared by many governments. For Mexico, though, some say that is not the real fragility. The problem is not the supplier. The problem is that we have no storage, says Rosanetti Barrios, a former energy official. When supply faltered during a freeze in Texas in 2021, Mexican factories and homes went dark within hours. The country has storage for just over 2 days of demand. By contrast, Spain can hold about 30 days' worth, France more than 100. And reliance on cheap gas, says Pedro Niembro of Monarch, a consultancy, has been a, quote, double-edged sword. It has curtailed the development of new renewable energy, he says. The U.S. Department of Energy reckons Mexico has the potential to produce enough to meet its electricity needs 100 times over. But last year, renewables contributed only 22% of electricity generation, falling short of the target of 35%. That leaves Mexico not only exposed to gas price swings, but also behind its peers in the energy transition. Ms. Sheinbaum, a climate scientist, shares much of her predecessor's energy ideology, but has more realistic ideas, though some of them might put her at odds with her Morena party. She has pledged to build storage capacity, upgrade pipelines, and raise domestic gas output by 25% by 2030. She has also hinted at allowing fracking, though Pemex's boss quickly denied this. Ms. Sheinbaum is more welcoming to public-private partnerships than her mentor, but she too thinks state firms should predominate. That risks supply. Pemex lacks both cash and expertise. Deep water gas fields, such as Lakic, now being revived with the involvement of Carlos Slim, a telecoms mogul, are costly and technically demanding. Private firms are interested, but the rules, and bitter memories from Mr. López Obrador's days, make them think twice. Mr. Ocampo says he does not see a way for Mexico to be competitive. Storage, better grids, policies to keep investors sweet, the path to less dependence on imported natural gas seems clear. Mexico should build the tanks, transmission lines, and trust, and perhaps worry less about the taps. That was an article from the Americas section. Put that in your pipe and store it. Mexico fears the United States will stop the flow of natural gas. Sheinbaum must confront her country's energy mess. And we'll move now to the United States section for struggle sessions. Donald Trump comes for America's public universities, but so far only those in enemy territory. On the eve of a new academic year, the campus of the University of California, Los Angeles, or UCLA, is tranquil. A few students wander around wearing backpacks. Banners declaring UCLA the country's, quote, number one public university are inescapable, a claim that rankles with the University of California, Berkeley, a state rival. A year ago, tents housing students who were protesting the war in Gaza filled a lawn where a young woman now sunbathes. But the calm masks deep anxieties. In July, the Department of Justice, or DOJ, alleged that UCLA was, quote, deliberately indifferent to the anti-Semitic harassment of Jewish and Israeli students perpetrated by protesters in the tent encampment. In response, the Trump administration froze $584 million in research grants from the National Science Foundation, or NSF, and the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, hindering studies on everything from Alzheimer's to opioids. To release the funding, President Donald Trump is asking for $1 billion, or roughly 9% of UCLA's annual budget, a ban on overnight protests, and a host of other changes. The DOJ gave the university until September 2nd to negotiate a deal or face a lawsuit. It's extortion. It's the only way to look at it, says Donald Heller, a former provost of the University of San Francisco. In some respects, UCLA's predicament is an extension of the administration's attacks on elite private institutions. As was true of Mr. Trump's fight with the Ivy League, California is one of the president's favorite foils. Attacking the Golden State is, at this point, a treasured pastime for this White House. But it also marks a new stage in Mr. Trump's shakedown of universities. If the administration succeeds in damaging the public universities that annoy him, i.e. the ones in Democrat-run states, the strain will have a broader impact than his attack on wealthy private schools. The Ivies educate less than 2% of America's college students. The vast majority, just shy of three-quarters of students, attend public universities like UCLA that are more extensively funded by taxpayers. Some of these schools do the most to foster upward mobility, yet they rarely make the news. An analysis by the Carnegie Foundation, a nonprofit, and the American Council on Education, or ACE, a trade association, identified 478, quote, opportunity colleges, places where a smart local student has a shot at admission and where earnings after graduation are high. None of the Ivies made the list. Elite private universities excel at research, but public ones produce lots of it too. Of the 10 universities that receive the most grant funding from the NSF, 7 are public and 3 are in the University of California, or UC, system. UCLA ranks 7th, Harvard 15th, and Columbia 19th. Recognizing the high stakes, the University of California's Board of Regents, which oversees the entire 10-campus system, has been tight-lipped about their negotiations with the administration. Gavin Newsom, the state's Democratic governor, who sits on the board, has characteristically made his opinion known, however. "We'll sue," he has said. Whether UCLA pursues a lengthy legal battle or settles for a large sum, it will be hard-pressed for funding. A federal judge has already told the administration to restore some of the frozen grants. Faculty and officials are hiking up to Sacramento, the state capital, to ask whether the legislature could help. New polling from Berkeley's Institute of Governmental Studies suggests that 58% of Californians would support increasing state funding for the UC system. Before the DOJ released the results of its anti-Semitism investigation, UCLA had already banned encampments and eliminated the use of, quote, diversity statements in hiring. Hours before the feds dropped the hammer, the university had settled a lawsuit with Jewish students. Anna Markowitz, president of the UCLA Faculty Association, calls this, quote, anticipatory obedience. "The UC didn't want to poke the bear," she says. But the bear is coming. Administrators at America's other public universities are also self-censoring. They are, no doubt, watching what happens in California while biting their fingernails. Many public universities are hoping to be more successful than UCLA at staying under the radar. In June, after grant-making slowed at the University of Washington, one of America's biggest research machines, the outgoing university president told local radio in Seattle that she wants to, quote, be pragmatic and not, quote, make big statements to make big statements. Public universities in Republican states have been reluctant to sign on to lawsuits against the federal government. That reflects local conservatism and also the fact that Mr. Trump does not seem inclined to harass schools in places where he has had political success. At Miami-Dade College in Florida, the country's biggest community college, there has been no disruption. Pell grants from the federal government cover tuition for 60% of students, but Madeline Pumariega, the president, is not worried that the Trump administration will go after them. "Our students aren't lying on the green grass, looking up at the sky, finding themselves. They're working towards getting jobs," she says. She reckons Mr. Trump supports that. When the government withheld NIH research grants from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, Katie Britt, a senator for Alabama, wrote to the White House to argue that it was in the interest of the Make America Healthy Again movement to fund research on cancer and chronic diseases. She also spoke with Mr. Trump. Soon, $15 billion in funds for Alabama and other universities were unfrozen. Her efforts, quote, chastened the administration, says one higher education policy wonk. Ohio State University, the alma mater of J.D. Vance, the vice president, has lost some federal funds, but not enough to force them to cut PhD programs or sack postdocs. Ted Carter, its president, attributes their relative immunity to the fact that the school, quote, stuck to its mission and stayed out of politics. Pro-Palestinian encampments on its campus were swiftly shut down by police and university leaders. When Mr. Carter visited the Oval Office with his championship-winning football team earlier this year, he told Mr. Trump that, quote, Ohio State is the institution that is going to get it right. Mr. Trump responded, I know you will. That was an article from the United States section, Struggle Sessions. Donald Trump comes for America's public universities, but so far, only those in enemy territory. And as noted earlier, in observance of the beginning of football season, we're going to go to the culture section for Lonely at the Top, quarterbacks shoulder an immense burden on the field, and life off the field is often harder. No position in team sports carries as much pressure and responsibility as the quarterback in American football. They direct every offensive play, which means they must know their team's entire playbook. Most of the highest-paid players in America's National Football League, or NFL, are quarterbacks. Often, 20 to 25% of a team's wages go to their quarterback. Signing the right quarterback is one of the most important decisions a team must make. Before the league's annual player draft, squads will sift through piles of reports, profiles, tests, and interviews. But Seth Wickersham, a journalist at ESPN, argues that, quote, no scouting processes have cracked the code or even clarified it. He reckons that most of the 69 quarterbacks chosen in the draft's first round since 2000 have been failures. In American Kings, Mr. Wickersham analyzes what it takes to be successful in such a singular role. He profiles some of the best quarterbacks, such as Bob Waterfield, who popularized football in Los Angeles, Johnny Unitas, the son of Lithuanian immigrants who became, quote, the first truly great quarterback to come out of nowhere. Mr. Wickersham spends time with his childhood hero, John Elway, who helped the Denver Broncos win two Super Bowls after three losses earlier in his career, and follows three young contenders through the quarterback industrial complex, from school to college to the NFL. One of these prospects is Colin Hurley, a 15-year-old. His dad, Charlie, is unusually enlightened for the father of a sport prodigy, and the pair appear to have a sweet rapport. In a telling moment, both are aghast as they watch a Netflix documentary about high school quarterbacks in which a father tears his son to shreds after poor play. Colin trains endlessly and does little else. Mr. Wickersham observes that he leads, quote, a fiercely limited existence in the hopes of an expansive life. College football is an extended apprenticeship for the NFL. It is also where a great winnowing takes place. Around 16,000 boys play quarterback in high school, but just 860 start in college. Would-be quarterbacks pick their destinations carefully, and colleges compete to attract the best. Mr. Elway recalls receiving a postcard from the cheerleading squad at the University of Missouri informing him, quote, we don't sleep with teddy bears. We only sleep with Missouri Tigers. He went to Stanford. As the sport has become increasingly guided by statistics, the tolerance for mistakes, or even quirks, has shrunk. Football has, quote, never seemed less real, less instinctive, less open to improvisation, Mr. Wickersham writes. American Kings argues that quarterbacks pay a high price for their fleeting moments of glory. few of those who make it to the summit are able to fully appreciate the view. Steve Young, a 3-time Super Bowl winner, says that being around other elite quarterbacks felt deflating, quote, because I wasn't quite as far along as I thought I was. When Mr. Elway finally wins the Super Bowl, his principal emotion was not joy, but relief. Unsurprisingly, life in retirement does not come easily either. Everyone with the luxury of myopically pursuing their dreams and then succeeding faces a transition into a less selfish version of adulthood, Mr. Wickersham diagnoses. There is a lot of drink, drugs, and infidelity. These vices are common across sports, but Mr. Wickersham contends that quarterbacks are particularly vulnerable. They have, quote, a deep and urgent imperative to dominate. Interactions with old friends, with accountants and business partners, with girlfriend and wives, are every bit as geared toward filling some bottomless hole in their personality as is calling a play. This is Mr. Wickersham's sad conclusion. He sets out hoping to learn how these men can repeatedly execute a perfect 60-yard spiral pass. He finds that this is the teachable bit that they will eventually commit to muscle memory. The trickier part is how to cope with everything outside the straight lines of the gridiron. That was an article from the Culture section. Lonely at the top. Quarterbacks shoulder an immense burden on the field, and life off the field is often harder. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the September 6th to September 12th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veitch, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfoandaudio/ On Demand.